The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Monday, August 25th, 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, we lip-sync our way through the Olympics closing ceremony. Then we bask in Team GB's Olympic successes.
Our cycling setup is phenomenal, and there are lessons to be learned from it across the full range of sports.
Plus, a look ahead to the Olympic legacy. Away from the Olympics, media types gather for the Edinburgh International TV Festival.
Those who want to reach big audiences with high-quality, popular television should be encouraged in that mission.
First, politics aside, few can doubt the success of the Beijing Olympics as a sporting showcase. And while the Chinese pat themselves on the back, the pressure is now on London to get ready for 2012. London Mayor Boris Johnson has taken the Olympic flag and with it the responsibility to make us all look good in 4 years' time.
Great thing this Games has done is it's helped to explode some of the kind of Olympo-scepticism there is in the UK. There's a lot of people in the UK who think, oh, the Olympic Games are going to be a complete waste of money, etc. I think a lot of people who were apathetic about the Games have been so enthralled and excited by what Team GB has done that they've become much more enthusiastic. I think it's going to be a great thing for the next 4 years.
So can our cheaper Olympics equal or better China's? The first test has been an eight-minute handover ceremony. Guardian columnist Marina Hyde was in Beijing to witness Britain's first impression on the Olympic stage.
The 8 minutes the London platform began with slightly shambolic London Mayor Boris Johnson walking up to the stage with International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roger, who then handed him the flag to the mayor of Beijing, and that mayor waved it six times. He then waved it six times himself, Jacques Roger, and then he handed it to Boris. Needless to say, it got in a bit of a tangle, and Boris's flag waving didn't pass off without complete incident. But he seemed to stifle his giggles reasonably well on the world stage. Then the bus began to enter. This is a sort of double-decker Route Master bus that entered, along with a sort of what appeared to be an urban dance troupe. And all the urban dance troupe appeared to then take on the characters of people waiting for the bus in London, that seminal London moment, that quintessential London moment of waiting for the bus. They then all seemed to scramble to try and get on the bus, but the door opened to reveal a small child who had a football with her. It was starting to fall slightly confusing at this point. And then at this point, the bus began to open up, and who should appear coming up on a large podium, rising from the bus, but Leona Lewis, apparently dressed as a cracker. Up came Jimmy Page, also on a sort of podium, looking a bit daddy cool. They then duetted on Whole Lot of Love together, while Leona was sort of suspended about 20 foot above the podium. And up came on another podium David Beckham in an entirely unbranded tracksuit. He merely smiled and waved and acknowledged the crowd before punting out a football into the crowd of athletes. And in fact, I think it was actually caught by a volunteer who was completely delighted. And all of a sudden, London's 8 minutes were over. I have to say it passed fairly quickly. I have to say that I actually went back and watched all the 8 minutes of everybody's handover section right back to Seoul this afternoon, and they're all completely rubbish. Everyone's is completely rubbish.
So are we better at doing rubbish than anyone else?
Yeah. Our rubbish can hold its own.
Team GB, a gold in rubbish. Marina, keep enjoying yourself. Thank you very much indeed for describing that to us. Back home, and the public has been urged to stay away from the homecoming of Britain's Olympic champions because of health and safety fears. So, no heroes welcome after the nation's best medal haul for 100 years. Joining us now is Guardian sports correspondent Simon Burnton to look at the highs and lows of Beijing 2008. And we did good, didn't we? Better, in fact, than expected.
Definitely fair to say. Certainly for the first week and a half, I think that athletics has been a little bit of a disappointment for Britain, and that came right at the end. And I don't think that we come out of this on a sour note, but it's a bit of a shame that we didn't hit our targets quite as emphatically in athletics as we did elsewhere. But overall, it's been brilliant.
Well, let's talk about some of those highlights. Chris Hoy and his thighs, the first Briton to get 3 golds at the same Games in 100 years.
Yeah, clearly our cycling setup is phenomenal, and there are lessons to be learned from it across the full range of sports. we'd prefer to be dominant in athletics or in swimming, but we'll take it where we can get it. For a weekend, and the track cycling lasted at its greatest intensity for no more than 3 days. But for those 3 days, Britain were the powerhouse, were the force at the Olympics. And however brief it was, it tasted good.
Bradley Wiggins and Victoria Pendleton, they deserve a mention.
Indeed. And Victoria Pendleton would have probably come out of the Games with as many gold as Hoy if there were as many women's events on the track as there are men's.
You mentioned the pool earlier. Rebecca Adlington prevailed there.
Yeah, it was wonderful to get a gold and a real feel-good factor in the pool, which has been a great disappointment for so many years for Britain. Her performance in the 800 metres, her strongest event, was fantastic. To break a record almost as old as she is by such an enormous distance was brilliant, wonderful to watch. Just exactly what we needed. So hopefully it is the start of something big and not the tail end of it, but we'll see that in the future.
Outstanding efforts from Usain Bolt, from his diet of chicken nuggets and yams, and of course Michael Phelps, who wolfed down his fried egg sandwiches with lots of mayo.
Yeah, it is amazing how Britain-centric the coverage is. Understandably in many ways, but look at the medals table and see how many gold medals China have won.
51
gold medals, and how many have you seen them win? Probably a couple in events where Britain also had someone. We've ignored huge swathes of... And the coverage on the BBC has been fantastic, but we've just simply ignored the majority of the Olympics to concentrate on what was good for us, and that's a bit of a shame.
So this Usain Bolt, what did he do?
Well, he broke records in anything he fancied, and what he fancied was the 100 metres, 200 metres, and the 4x100-metre relay. Jamaica were very dominant in the sprint events. He's Jamaican. And not only did he break every record he fancied and win every event he entered, but he did it while being really laid back, tremendously cool, dancing in a slightly weird fashion. The big difference between him, Phelps won 8 gold medals in the pool, and he did so in a kind of chest-beating, slightly aggressive, American juvenile male way that, while tremendously impressive, still... I don't know. I didn't love him in the way that I embrace everything that Bolt is. He was wonderful.
Shall we finish by mentioning that we got more medals than Australia, so their sports minister, Kate Ellis, is going to have to wear British colours now, isn't she, at an Australian event?
Yeah, we look forward to that. And that Australia are a sport-mad nation, and we watched them in 2000 with awe at how well they organised the Sydney Games and how well they did in them, and we thought how much better they were than us and how we were never going to be able to equal them. And here we are, 2 Olympics on, thrashing them in the medals table. I think that we've learned how it feels to win from time to time over the last couple of weeks. I mean, I probably speak for all of us when saying that we could get used to this. I look forward to a bit more.
The Guardian's sports correspondent, Simon Burnton. More to come on the Olympics shortly. Plus, you can find analysis of the games at guardian.co.uk/sport. Elsewhere on the Guardian's website today, the lengths cocaine traffickers go to get their product to the UK. That's at guardian.co.uk/news. Details on the crash of a Boeing passenger jet in Kyrgyzstan's capital, Bishkek, at guardian.co.uk/world. Carol Thatcher on the extent of Mrs. T's dementia. Guardian.co.uk/politics. Reggie Perrin set to return to our TV screens. Details at guardian.co.uk/culture. And the priest who wants a Miss Nun contest. Habits at the ready at guardian.co.uk/society. Now, having revelled in Team GB's success, we ask, has the Olympics improved Britain's feel-good factor? We may be in an economic slump, but we did get 19 golds. A Guardian ICM poll shows that 18 to 34-year-olds are getting into the Olympic spirit, but the over-65s are a little more grumpy. The Guardian's Will Woodward has been looking at the figures for us.
What we found is that a large majority of people are very pleased that the Olympics are coming to London, and they also think it will be good for Britain. And around 80%, 4/5 of the population, think it will be very good for the country. Support is particularly pronounced, it seems, among the under-35s, both the 18 to 24 age group and the 24 to 35 age group are more enthusiastic than the over-65s. Maybe they think they've got more chance of going to them. Among the 25 to 34 age group, 90% of people say it will be good for Britain. The poll was carried out a week ago, pretty much as Olympic fever was beginning to take off. Although we hadn't had a lot of the successes on the track and field then, we'd had Usain Bolt's 100-metre world record. Michael Phelps won all the rest of his swimming golds that weekend. And also we'd started to have big successes in the cycling and the rowing and the swimming. Rebecca Adlington was around that time. So I think this poll is representative of time, perhaps when people were just starting to get excited. And there is a bit of nervousness around whether the government should spend more money on helping Britain's elite athletes. 52% support that, 45% oppose that. And again, that 18 to 24 age group, a majority of them oppose extra taxpayers' money being spent. Maybe they think it's going to be them that's footing the bill.
The Guardian's Will Woodward. And with the final day celebrations now over and the baton passed to London, the race has already started to put together Team GB for 2012. Loughborough University has been holding trials for more than 150 young women in an initiative by UK Sport called Girls for Gold. Our North of England editor Martin Wainwright has been to watch the tryouts for The Guardian.
In front of me is a scene of people pedalling on exercise machines, running, jumping, hopping, doing everything, which I'm not very good at. You can probably hear instructors in the background issuing the orders. In order to qualify here, you've got to be a sportswoman of at least county level. And the idea is that they'll start to work out which ones of them show the potential for Olympic sports competition. I've just come to have a word with Natalie Donman, who's now... would you mind telling me what you are, Natalie? I know you're scientific.
Yeah, I'm a talent ID scientist with the English Institute of Sport.
Now, that really interests me. I've never heard of a talent ID scientist, but that means that out of all these young women here, who to me all look, you know, brilliant at running and jumping and everything else, you can take things further and get an idea of the ones that really might excel.
Yeah, that's right. We work very much in partnership with the governing bodies and the coaches and scientists within the governing bodies and other scientists within the Institute to have a look at these girls and the scores that they're getting on these tests in conjunction with their sporting background. And then we start to look at where we think they might be best placed to go on and be very successful. At this early phase one stage, it's very much about the physical and physiological testing. However, we do look when they're competing some of the longer, harder tests, so the 3-minute test on the bike and the all-out test there on the Schwinn bike. We really look at whether they've pushed themselves to the limit or whether they've sort of stopped a bit early and they could have gone further. So we do have a look at that at this early stage. But this stage, it's very much about the physical and physiological attributes in conjunction with their training background. Then when we go on to phase two and we look at a smaller group, we then start to go a bit more in depth into the drive, the motivation, the psychological factors at that next stage.
I'm with Jessica Whitehorn now from UK Sport. Jessica, would you mind explaining to me, I mean, this is like a kind of X factor for woman Olympian, potential woman Olympian?
I guess it is in a way, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a project called Girls for Gold. It's a project between UK Sport and the English Institute of Sport in partnership with the Olympic sports of cycling, sailing, rowing, canoeing, modern pentathlon and bob skeleton.
And were those, sorry to interrupt you, were those chosen because they're the ones that we, as has been demonstrated over the last 10 days, that we're good at?
Partly. They're all sports with very good systems in place and also sports with a history of taking girls and fast-tracking them to the podium very, very quickly. Because they've just got, I mean, for example, Rebecca Romero obviously has transferred very quickly from rowing into cycling, and also Shelley Rubman in bob skeleton. She was a 400-metre hurdler and she won her Olympic medal within 3 years of taking up bob skeleton. So they're all sports with where we think this can work, basically.
Well, good luck. I hope out of all these girls, gold emerges.
Yeah,
I'm sure it will.
Hidden gems.
And I'll say hidden today.
The Guardian's North of England editor Martin Wainwright.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
I'm Mike Duran. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, what the TV industry is worried about.
We could let fragmentation wash the old order away, or we can fight to say that broad is the key part of broadcasting.
Plus, Britain's Costa del Sewage, the UK's fetid coastline.
This is where bacterial loads can get quite heavy due to the storm sewer overflows running, and then they discharge right at the point of the beach here.
To America first, where Convention Fortnight begins in Denver, Colorado. Barack Obama will address his supporters exactly 45 years after Martin Luther King invited America to share his dream. Obama starts the week with his ratings lower than those of the Democratic Party itself. his popularity among the white working class a major concern for his team. In a bid to reverse his fortune, Obama has introduced his presidential running mate, Joe Biden, a 65-year-old with impeccable blue-collar credentials and labour union contacts. The Guardian's US election team reports now on what we can expect from the most eagerly awaited convention of the past four decades.
I'm Suzanne Goldenberg, US correspondent of The Guardian. Well, this convention is really about jump-starting Barack Obama's campaign for the White House. He's now got his vice president, that's Joe Biden, and together the two of them want to really get this campaign energized. They want to unite the Democratic Party around them. And most importantly, they need to sort of halt the slide in their poll numbers. They need to really come out of here on a high and go and start the last sort of weeks of the campaign.
I'm Michael Tomasky, editor of Guardian America. The nominee's speech is the opportunity for him to state his biography, state his rationale for being president, talk about his vision for the country in his highest profile, by far, platform that he'll have.
This is crucial if Barack Obama is going to get this campaign off to a flying start. First of all, he needs to come out of Denver with a clear message of what he stands for and what he and the Democrats can do for the country if he is elected president. Barack Obama also needs to convince Democrats, his own party people, to support him. Crucially, he has to win over disgruntled supporters of Hillary Clinton. He has to show that he takes her seriously, that he respects her, and that he will carry forward some of the ideas that she stood for. Those are the two main challenges here. He has to show what he stands for, and he has to bring the party behind him.
The Clintons loom very large here. Some 20 to 25% of Hillary Clinton's voters say they're going to vote for John McCain. That's a huge number. It's not a number that Barack Obama can really live with or win with, I don't think. So he's got to get that whittled down to a more reasonable 5, 6, 7%. There's a lot of guessing about whether the Clintons really will enthusiastically endorse Obama and campaign for him and speak well of him and urge her supporters to vote for him. The more cynical people even suspect that she wants him to lose so that she can run again in 2012. And these are very real concerns. And I think Bill Clinton, just on a personal level, seems to really dislike Barack Obama. And seems, you know, to be worried that, you know, Obama's gonna steal his thunder and that, you know, he'll no longer be the great rock star of the Democratic Party.
There is really a sense of history to this convention in all sorts of aspects. For one, you've got to consider the location. Denver has not been the site for a Democratic convention in exactly a century. So by hosting it here, the Democrats really want to show that they're serious about winning the election in the West. Barack Obama's targeting Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada. The Democrats really see that this year the road to the White House is through the West. So that's one aspect of history. You know, there's all sorts of echoes here in Barack Obama's candidacy to JFK. He's consciously trying to use those images and to sort of make people feel that here again, there we have a young, fresh-faced candidate for president who can do great things and bring back that spirit of optimism. At the same time, you know, the Democrats are also trying to look back to the 1990s when Bill Clinton was in power and to sort of draw a contrast between that era of economic prosperity in the last 8 years under George Bush.
For the very latest in the race for the White House, go to guardian.co.uk/America. Following a year of phone-in scandals and that faked documentary on the Queen, TV's most talented, or certainly highest paid, advocates have been gathering at the Media Guardian Edinburgh International TV Festival. Presenter of Guardian's Media Talk, Matt Wells, reports from the Edinburgh International Conference Centre.
A year ago, the British TV industry was in crisis, engulfed in accusations of fraud and fakery. Over the bank holiday weekend this year at the Edinburgh TV Festival, executives, producers and stars tried to put the past behind them. The theme of the event was I Love TV, but that didn't mean there weren't voices of dissent. TV industry is still woefully underrepresentative of ethnic minorities, and one former British black TV executive, Patrick Young, who has now moved to the US, said bosses who don't meet their diversity targets should be fired. On Sunday, the celebrated satirist Armando Iannucci said the balance of power in the TV industry had shifted away from the programme makers in favour of the bosses. That should change, he said, and he called for the BBC to set up an HBO-style subscription service to make and showcase the best drama and comedy. The main event, though, was the James McTaggart Memorial Lecture, delivered this year by the director of television at ITV, Peter Fincham, sacked last year by the BBC over the faking of a promo clip involving the Queen. Fincham's brief was to re-energise an embattled industry, and he started by knocking an easy target, the regulator, Ofcom, and its public service broadcasting report.
What you'll find in this report, and it's echoed in Channel 4's lengthy doorstopper Next on 4, is a version of television that's understood by regulators, consultants, strategists, and media commentators. It has a language all its own. I dare say we'll hear plenty of it this weekend. It likes to imagine television as a form of social engineering. Unfortunately, if the person in the street or indeed on the sofa were to overhear us talking this language, they'd wonder what on earth we were talking about.
He went on to criticise a public survey carried out by Ofcom, saying it was skewed to show that audiences didn't want entertainment.
So there we have it. Let's scrap Saturday nights completely. Drama's out, comedy too. No role for sport, the Champions League, Euro 2008, the Olympics. The 14 million people who tuned into the finals of Britain's Got Talent weren't there to be entertained, but to watch TV promote understanding of religions, cultures and lifestyle. Don't get me wrong. Television needs regulators just as roads need traffic wardens. But you wouldn't ask your traffic warden to give you advice on what sort of car to buy, still less how to drive it.
And he concluded with a barnstorming rallying call for popular television.
Between now and 2012, we have a choice. We could let fragmentation wash the old order away and seek comfort in television that ticks the right boxes. Or we can fight to say that broad is the key part of broadcasting, that television will serve society better if it unites audiences than if it scatters them, that regulators and politicians can make all the highfalutin demands they like, but if people don't turn on to watch, we're all just whistling in the wind, and that those who want to reach big audiences with high-quality popular television should be encouraged in that mission.
Director of Television at ITV, Peter Fincham, ending that report from The Guardian's Matt Wells. Finally, with the party leaders encouraging us to spend the summer holidays at the British seaside, there's something they haven't been telling us, and that is that the wet summer means more raw sewage is being pumped into the sea around the coast. Some waste pipes are discharging constantly when they shouldn't be. The Guardian's Robert Booth has been to Porthtowan, a blue flag beach in Cornwall, to see the brown sludge for himself.
I'm Richard Martin, chartered civil engineer. I live in Bosinney. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been monitoring the beach outfall of the sewage coming out of the Bosinney part of Tintagel. This pipe has been broken for over 20 years. We have written to various people to ask for it to be repaired, but nothing's been done, pending all the public inquiries in South West Water, trying to get the sewage work sorted. The effect on the water is that because it is a narrow, small bay of about 150 metres each way, the water doesn't actually travel out unless the tide and the waves are extremely active. Now, while it's sitting in the bay, it's just swilling around in that small area, and it needs currents and winds in the correct direction to actually suck it out into the what the Environment Agency laughingly call the aggressive North Atlantic. All of this seawater will be swept round the headland to the right-hand side there and round back into the Bosinney Bay, which is very well used by holidaymakers, by the caravan sites nearby and by surfers.
Richard and I have gone round the headland to Tintagel, where everything's King Arthur's coffee shop, King Arthur's tea room,
the round table stamp shop, all themed on the idea that King Arthur was conceived here. And now we're walking down to Tintagel Bay, where there's another sewage outflow. It's just stopped raining. It's incredible weather for August, and that's part of the problem here, which is the more rainwater that comes off, the more it flows through the sewage pipes, pushing effluent out to sea. What you can see is the brown sludge just pumping out of the pipe, forced through with the huge amounts of rain that we've had this summer, and swirling out into the open ocean. And the seabirds enjoying the effluent, but the smell as it rises up is really distinctive. And it's really not something you'd want to come across on a holiday or a visit to Tintagel, and I'm sure it's not the kind of thing that King Arthur would have thought of.
This is an area of outstanding natural beauty. The tourists come here to use the coast path because of that, and we've got all sorts of interest. I'm looking at people walking around where the old Iron Age fort is on Willow Park. We don't want sewage or the effect of sewage to chase our visitors away. It's our sole form of income in this town.
It's just not nice. It's a shame, really, because I think you'd like to take children to the beach and things when you come to Cornwall. I wouldn't fancy going in there, put it that way.
The raw sewage pipes at Tintagel are increasingly rare in Britain, but problems remain with several thousand sewage overflows that regularly pump often untreated sewage into the sea. Rich Hardy, the campaigns director of Surfers Against Sewage, based in Cornwall, took me along the course of the Red River, which runs into St Ives Bay. He wanted to show me how this summer's heavy rains have resulted in sewage being pumped into the sea.
This is Gadrevy Beach. It's the far end of St Ives Bay. And as you can see, this is where we meet the Red River again. This is its point of entry into the North Atlantic. This is where bacterial loads can get quite heavy due to the storm sewer overflows running, and then they discharge right at the point of the beach here.
But there's surf schools here and bathers and hikers. It's a busy beach.
Yeah, I mean, look at the weather today. It's awful, yet this beach is week in, week out packed. And this isn't just the summer either. This is like all year round this beach is used heavily.
And Rich, what are some of the kind of things that you can catch if you sort of ingest any of this water?
Well, common complaints because of poor water quality, a result of sewage effluents, range from gastroenteritis, ear, nose, throat infections. Yeah, they're quite common cases. But also things like impetigo, hepatitis A virus can survive in seawater for up for a month. Particularly with the sports that involve immersion and ingestion, like surfing, like bodyboarding, this is when your chances of getting sick can get higher. And I mean, that's scientifically proven that, you know, people like surfers are three times at more risk than the average bather for picking up something like gastroenteritis.
Well, that's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Ian Chambers. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.